For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website. So, good morning. My name is Aishin Nancy Easton, and I am the director at Ancient Dragon, and I'm giving the talk today because Taigen is away out of town, and so I'm happy to be here. Pleased to meet the people who are here for the first time. Welcome. I am going to be talking today about the middle way. Can everyone in the back hear me okay? I will try to speak up. And I decided that I wanted to talk about the middle way after hearing, as some of you may have 2 weeks ago here, hearing Eric Gnozon talk about practice in his life and how, I'll just tell you sort of this, one of the key points that I took away from Gnozon's talk was about how For me, this was true, and I think he said it was true for him, and I think it's true for most of us. In the beginning, we come to practice for a reason. We think, you know, it's going to do something for us or help us be some way, or we think that we should do something. And he likened this to vegetarianism and that we think we should do things for a reason. And what he was saying, what I heard him saying, was that over time, practice has just become a part of his life, and it's not a good necessarily a good thing or a bad thing or a thing that will do anything in particular for him, or he doesn't do it for any reasons. And I just love that. It's just part of who he is, and he doesn't do it perfectly. And this was a great talk if you get a chance to hear it online. And it made me think about the middle way. And hopefully by the end of my talk, you will know why it made me think of the middle way. But in thinking about talking about the middle way, I needed to do a little bit of scholarly research. So you'll get some of that as well as, you know, my own understanding of what the middle way is in my life. And maybe we can have a discussion later on how people sort of envision the middle way in their lives. And the middle way, for if you have not heard anyone use this phrase, it's central to all Buddhist teachings, and it's really, I think, you know, Buddhism is considered to be the middle way. The middle way, Zen has been called the middle way, but actually, it comes from originally the first teachings of the Buddha. It's found in the first teachings of the Buddha, in the Four Noble Truths. You know, the Buddha diagnosed the world, I think, pretty accurately by saying, you know, there is suffering. Some would say everything is suffering. Some would say suffering is pervasive. But, you know, the Buddha said the first noble truth is that there is suffering. And I think we have all encountered that at different times. He then went on to say, out of his own, you know, enlightened perspective, that suffering arises because of our craving or grasping at things and our ignorance about this. And we might think of this now as, you know, the sort of the three: greed, hate, and delusion. We try to cling on to things that we want. We try to push away things that we don't want. We can be very deluded or ignorant or just confused about, you know, what we're doing with that. And that, but those activities and the mind that you know creates those activities creates suffering. So that's the second noble truth. The third noble truth is that there is a way out of suffering. And the way out of suffering is the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is also called specifically the middle way, and it is a path of finding a way to live between sort of indulging our senses and, you know, complete austerity or sort of self-annihilation. And if you think back to the life of the Buddha was born into a, you know, very wealthy sort of, you know, noble royal circumstance where there was quite a lot of, you know, encouragement of indulging the senses to entice him to stay in that. And when he left, he practiced with ascetics who were very austere, very much trying to sort of, you know, mortify themselves. And what he derived from his enlightenment was a middle way between those, and that and he called it the Eightfold Path, and it consists of right view or right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, and these things are maybe built on each other. You may wonder what makes these practices right. How do you find the right practice? And I'm not going to get into that too deeply, except to say that right view or right speech or right action is based on a thorough understanding or observation of cause and effect and how things that we do can lead to suffering or can lead to, you know, the cessation of suffering or the removal of suffering. And so Buddha taught that by observing ourselves and how we conduct ourselves in the world, we can use this sort of path as the way out of suffering. One thing that I want to, I think has been, you know, sometimes debated or questioned, There are a couple different schools of Buddhism. There's the Theravada, or used to be called Hinayana school of Buddhism, which is kind of called the Way of the Elders, versus the Mahayana way, school of Buddhism. And Zen is part of the Mahayana school of Buddhism. Sometimes people talk about the Theravada school as being sort of the original teachings of the Buddha. But it's actually true that Buddha taught both some of the teachings that are emphasized in the Theravada tradition and as well the teachings that are emphasized in the Mahayana tradition of sort of a universal end to suffering. But it appears that some of the Theravada traditions, which are focused on conducting oneself in such a way as to sort of lead oneself out of suffering, they appear to have been a little bit more used and universally understandable during the Buddha's lifetime, and so that was, I think, something that, you know, the Buddha maybe focused on a little bit more at that time. But the Mahayana teachings are no less the teaching of the Buddha. And so there was, you know, perhaps in that time a little bit more of a focus on individual awakening or individual liberation. And there still is today. You may go to places where people practice more of a Theravada approach. So that's sort of the early history. About, I don't know, I think it's not completely clear, maybe 600 to 900 years later, there was a very famous Buddha ancestor named Nagarjuna, who was the founder of the Madhyamaka school. And Madhyamaka means literally middle way. And he wrote sort of the fundamental text on the middle way during roughly the 1st to 4th century. Nagarjuna is considered the 14th ancestor after Buddha. And what he tried to do was to make the Buddha's original teachings a little bit more accessible to the people of his time, and I think was extremely successful with this. One focus of Nagarjuna was that he tried to explain ultimate reality not by philosophy. When we use philosophy to explain reality, we try to, you know, come up with answers to sort of why questions. Why does this happen? Why, you know, why is there cause and effect? But what Nagarjuna focused on was explaining ultimate reality by observation. So instead of asking why questions or trying to search for answers to why questions, which really leads us to concepts and speculation and a lot of stuff in our head, he recommended that we observe how. You know, how do things happen? This happens, and then this happens. And so Nagarjuna has sort of three interconnected observations or ideas, and they were, the first would be shunyata, or emptiness, in which things are not, things don't not exist. They don't, you know, they don't exist or not exist, but they don't have a single unifiable self or construct that in fact, everything is a product of the second concept, which is dependent co-arising, that everything kind of depends on itself and on each other, and everything brings everything else into being all at once. So that would be sort of the second observation, that, that everything is empty, and because everything is empty, it also relies on everything else. You cannot have, for instance, a location in space without something occupying that location, even if it's, you know, even if it's air right here. It looks like there's nothing here where my, you know, where my hand is pointing to, but there's something there. You can't have a location without a, without an object, and you can't have an object without it being located someplace. So nothing exists independently. He also talked about the third observation or idea is that there are two truths. There's conventional reality and there's ultimate reality. And in fact, these three aspects of reality, emptiness, dependent co-arising, and conventional and ultimate truth, actually function together and they can never be separated, but we can kind of observe them artificially by focusing on one at a time. For example, with emptiness, my favorite example of emptiness is the elbow. And I will demonstrate. So we all have an elbow somewhere, right? Somewhere. So is this my, would you say that this was my elbow? I mean, we generally, I think most people think that this is the elbow. Is this the elbow? This I think maybe is also the elbow, and this is also the elbow. If I'm right here, if this is the elbow, is this the elbow? It's hard to say. And the elbow, we know from, you know, looking from taking apart elbows, that they are made of several bones and ligaments and muscles, and there's skin, and there's no really one thing that can be called the elbow. I think it's much more clear than if you, you know, think about your hand. Your hand is made of five fingers, sure, but you know, it's a hand and it ends somewhere in here. But the elbow, I think the elbow is kind of up for grabs. You know, what is it? Where is it? There's human elbows, and then there's, you know, elbow joints. Another example that I think Tygen likes to use a lot is your third grade teacher. Can you raise your hand if you remember your third grade teacher? You remember who that was? Okay. Do you remember anything that that person said to you ever? Raise your hand if you remember anything that your third grade teacher ever said, anything they taught you, anything you learned in third grade. I know, so I'm getting a lot of blank looks. Perhaps you don't remember what you learned in third grade. I know in third grade, if your third grade was like my third grade, you might have learned cursive writing, and you might have learned multiplication, sort of basic multiplication tables. Certainly there was some addition and subtraction. We learned those at one time, maybe in third grade, maybe not in third grade, but those are a part of you now. You know, you go to, I don't know, you know, you go put money on your bus pass and you have to figure out, okay, how many rides will I get if I put like another $10 on this bus pass? That knowledge came to you from somewhere and it is part of you now, but it isn't, you know, and maybe it came from your third grade teacher, maybe it came from your fourth grade teacher. It came from somewhere else. It's not, you know, intrinsically you. Nothing, in fact, has an intrinsic essence, and nothing can exist without the benefit of having had other things. You know, we can't exist without each other and without all the beings in the past who helped us be here now. And so because all of those things depend on each other, that is, you know, very much related to dependent co-arising. And Nagarjuna, in the fundamental text on the Middle Way, said, whatever is dependently co-arisen, that is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the Middle Way. That, I think it's maybe one important thing to say about the Middle Way is it's not in the middle, actually. It's there's actually no middle. I think it just is a good word to distinguish the ways in which it's not one thing or another. It actually maybe kind of unites both things and transcends both things. It encompasses everything. So we have emptiness, we have dependent co-arising, we have everything depending on everything else, and then we have conventional versus ultimate reality. And I think you know, if you think about it, we all kind of know what conventional reality is, and to a certain extent we agree on what that is. Conventional reality is just our day-to-day experience, just our ordinary mind, our ordinary day. There are some things that we know about our ordinary experience, which is, for instance, you know, if you stand in the rain, you will get wet. That is pretty much a clear-cut cause and effect. It's raining, you're there, you will get wet. It's also true that when we are hurt, we experience pain, and you know that for yourself. But I think a step removed from this example is that even if you are not presently in pain, you can kind of understand empathically that someone else who has hurt themselves might be in pain. Or you don't necessarily know how much pain or how they are, you know, experiencing that pain, but you know that there is some pain. So there's some commonly understood, shared reality that isn't quite so direct as cause and effect. There's also, I think we all know from conventional reality, whether you agree with it or not, that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. Right? Yeah, more or less. But if you pull apart this sentence, you have the sun rises in the east, sets in the west. You have a couple of very clear dualities, first of all. There's you know, if duality involves things and their opposite, or things and their complement. So wherever there's east, there's also west. So those would be maybe a dependently co-arisen concept. Rising and setting, the sun, that's another kind of pair of duality, that the sun is going up, it's coming down. It's going up from our perspective, and it's coming down from our perspective, but it's not really going up or down. You know, it's just going, and the earth is moving, and it looks like it's going up and down, or rising and setting. Also the sun. I mean, the sun is another, maybe it's harder to see than east versus west, but the sun is also sort of a codependently arisen thing. You know, does anybody know what the sun actually consists of? I think there's helium and hydrogen and stuff, right? I mean, stuff that's not just like sun, you know, there's gases and heat and flame and I don't really know what all, but I do know that it's not the sun, okay? even though we call it the sun. So none of these things are ultimate truth. It is truth from our perspective. And some of what Nagarjuna says is that mistaking conventional reality for ultimate reality is ignorance, which leads to the cycle of suffering or samsara. That when we take things that we can observe and we create, you know, rules about them, the rules may be, you know, accurate to various degrees, but they're really just our concept, and it really that's actually just ignorance to one degree or another. And so another aspect of this is that, you know, our tendency to then convert the world around us into objects, like, you know, converting all the things that make up the sun into something and calling it the sun. Although this is both, you know, kind of observably true from our ordinary perspective and necessary if we want to somehow navigate, you know, life in this world, our tendency to do that, to convert things into objects and concepts, leads us to believe that things and us have independent self-existence. I know for a fact that the person that each of you presents as right now is not the same person that each of you maybe presented as 20 years ago. You know, some of you may have been children, some of you may have been in a very different circumstance. And yet, you know, there's a question of are you still the same person? In some ways, yes, and in other ways, you have become, you know, in some ways, it's very different people. So we, even ourselves, don't have independent self-existence. We are constantly changing, constantly taking in, you know, information and making that a new part of us, and maybe constantly losing things as well. So in conventional reality, emptiness and dependent co-arising interact to create emptiness. So where there is big, there is small. Where there is good, there is evil. But because everything is dependently co-arisen, nothing really fundamentally exists. So in ultimate reality, there is really no duality. Everything is really just empty. There is no essence. And conventional and ultimate reality, by this, from this perspective, could be seen to be one. And if you've ever heard the phrase samsara is nirvana, that, you know, our sort of the world of samsara that we live in and the world of ultimate reality or nirvana are one, that's kind of what that's referring to. And I will leave it to people who are more, you know, learned and profound than I am to really delve into that. I think I'm just going to take that on at face value that it is true. I think when I think about it from my perspective, it makes me think about how, you know, we've learned over the past 100 years that light is both particle and wave, and it depends on, you know, where and how you observe it. And I think that is maybe a sort of a good analogy for conventional and ultimate reality. So Nagarjuna was concerned with helping people help with their tendency to search for reasons for cause and effect, and tried to, I think, you know, point out that there isn't really a meaning of life that we can cling to as the truth of existence. And, you know, I think said that there, you know, maybe there are provisional meanings or rules to existence, but this is still, you know, just an understanding from our limited perspective. It is not. I'm not sure that there's anything that is always 100% true. And the founder of our lineage in America, Shinryu Suzuki, was the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. And there's a very famous book of his talks that was compiled by his students called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which probably everyone's heard of and maybe has read. There was a second book compiled of his talks that was entitled Not Always So. And I love that phrase, and I think not always so is, you know, maybe a way that we can think about the middle way. The middle way is that, you know, things are provisional. You know, emptiness, everything is empty, but even emptiness is empty. So there's no real essence to anything. And yet, you know, we still have to get to work and take care of our lives, and there still is suffering. And one thing that I think is at least conventionally universally true is that everyone wants to avoid suffering. Creatures want to avoid suffering. We want to avoid suffering, and we want to, you know, maybe try to help others avoid suffering as well, because there, you know, if there's no real separation between ourselves and others, then we're all trying to sort of help each other, you know, to remove ourselves from suffering. And I guess that's where the Mahayana comes in, because you know, part of the Mahayana focus is that truth. The idea that truth is to be found in practice and in the practice of Buddhist teachings as a way of removing suffering. And Zen, the school of Buddhism that we practice, is part of Mahayana thinking. And Mahayana thinking is the word I think means great vehicle. The idea is that in Mahayana teachings, everyone awakens together, everyone is, you know, liberated together, and everyone gets there together. If the Theravada or which used to be called Hinayana, was sort of the lesser vehicle. It was maybe, you know, you drive in a car and you get someplace. And with Mahayana teaching, everybody gets on the bus and everybody goes there. And we're never able to really extricate ourselves from our interconnectedness with other people. So other people and everything. So Zen is very much concerned with practice and with breaking free from discursive logic, breaking free from our thinking that is so caught up in duality, like the pairs of good or bad, gain or loss. Each side of a dualistic pair contains its opposite. You know, whenever something nice arises in your mind, it also brings with it, you know, even if it's in the very background, an awareness that if there's nice, there's also not nice. And one of the central texts that we sometimes chant is the harmony of sameness and difference, that kind of focuses on this, that everything goes together, box and lid fit, arrow points meet. We have a front and back foot in walking, and they're changing all the time. So by practice, the idea is that we can maybe loosen our tendency to search for an essential nature to things, and, you know, thereby free ourselves and maybe awaken to the reality of life. So I'm going to talk. I think the rest of my talk, I want to try to focus on practice, and maybe we can have a little bit of a discussion also about, you know, how to practice with this middle way where things are not always as they appear to be, nor are they other than what they appear to be, to quote another quote from Nagarjuna. So one important thing to remember is that Zen teachings are seen as what's called upaya. Upaya is a Sanskrit word that means skillful means. Skillful means to help a student toward liberation, not the answer, and I'll get into that in a minute. I missed one little piece back to Nagarjuna, which is that part of what Nagarjuna was saying is that cause and effect just is. Conventional reality just is. And because that is true, that is ultimate reality, that things are. They're empty, they're dependently co-arising, and that's it. So teachings in Zen are a way to hopefully help to explicate this. One thing that I realized a few weeks back when Shohaku Okamura Roshi was here teaching was that I have a tendency to see, you know, we read koans or Zen koans or teaching stories and we think, okay, there's got to be an answer here. And I, you know, and you hear somebody's answer and you think, okay, maybe that's the answer, and you can try to memorize the answer. But it's not really the answer. And it's koans or any kind of teaching in Zen is really supposed to be a skillful means to help us free our mind from some of this, you know, discursive thinking, even discursive thinking that there is an answer. So there are a couple koans that illustrate this to me really nicely. The first one is there's the koan where Yaoshan asks Mazu, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the East? And the word meaning, having sat through this talk for a while, should trigger something in your mind of, okay, wait, we were not going to try to find out why. You know, the word meaning kind of signifies, like, why did Bodhidharma come from the East, which is another question. And so there's something a little bit maybe suspect in this question. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the East? And Mazu's answer, which I think is, I don't know what I think it is, but I love it. So his answer is, sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink his eyes, sometimes I don't make him raise his eyebrows and blink his eyes. Sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is right, sometimes raising the eyebrows and blinking is not right. How about you? And I love, what one thing I love about his answer is the sometimes. You know, sometimes. Sometimes things are like this. Sometimes things are not like this. Sometimes, I don't know, you know, sometimes getting up in the morning and going for a bike ride is the right thing to do. Sometimes it is not the right thing to do. And I think that that is true for anything in our life. And I think, you know, Mazu is trying to say there's not a meaning. There's not one, you know, meaning that's outside of you. There's, you know, what makes raising your eyebrow, well, that's, let me try something else. What makes crossing the street at the intersection when you have the light right, and what makes it not right? I mean, one thing that makes it right is that if there are cars coming, you will be cautious and you will not get hit by a car. One thing that might make it not right is if someone is, like, you know, chasing you and you know, threatening you, and you need to sort of get away from that situation, you might not want to just sort of stand there and, you know, wait for the light, and, you know, go to the crosswalk. You know, you need to get out of there. So that's what I mean, that there, everything that we do depends on our context and our situation. I think someone asked Suzuki Roshi one time, I think, you know, what are we trying to find, you know, with practice? And I think his answer was an appropriate response. You know, what makes something right or you know, correct is that it's an appropriate response to the situation. Sometimes I make him raise his eyebrows and blink his eyes. Sometimes I don't. You know, it's funny because you may have heard this question before. What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the East? You may have heard that in another koan, in another context. And you may have also heard that the answer to the koan was the cypress tree in the garden. And that is just as much, you know, the two koans sort of sit side by side, and one answer is just as much an answer to the question as another. It depends on the context. I imagine in this context, there was a cypress tree in the courtyard, and, you know, somebody found that to be inspiring. And so that was the answer. So how can we practice with this if everything is dependent on, you know, what did I just say? If everything is dependent on our context and our situation, you know, one thing that maybe practice can involve. Practice is really studying ourselves, right? You know, you study yourself to become illuminated by everything arising. So one aspect of practicing might involve observing our concepts and seeing that they're really relative. And maybe try to observe when we are relating to a concept in our mind. And I'll give you some clues for this. One clue that you are relating to a concept is the use of an adjective. So if you are experiencing something as nice or big or loud or correct or, you know, rude, there's a concept there, and there's some duality there, because there's also, you know, there's not rude, and there's our judgment maybe involved in that situation. Another clue would be extremes, finding something to be good or evil, or having fixed views. You know, we talk in the Metta Sutta about not holding to fixed views, not believing that, you know. Even, you know, you may have be able to think readily of someone in your life who has really hurt you. And and they did some things that really were bad. And yet you may be in a place where you can see that person or maybe a lesser person who's harmed you in a lesser way as not 100% bad, but, you know, maybe confused or hurting or unaware of what they were doing or... So finding a way to pick apart such extremes or fixed views as good or bad, rules. If we think that we are following a rule, that is another aspect of being in conventional reality. that, you know, even forms, I think people who have been here for a while, but will know some forms for how we conduct ourselves in the Zendo, and people who are just joining us for the first time, I think just got a lesson in, you know, here you do this, and you bow, and you turn, and you walk behind the altar, and these are actually, all of these things are upaya if we study them. They're not, you know, they're not the rule for, like, how to be the best Zen student or how to be, you know, really, really good. We don't really gain anything by avoiding extremes of happiness or sadness in our lives. The goal isn't to get to, you know, somewhere in the middle where we're just sort of living without having a lot of feelings. The goal is to just observe these and see how, you know, what they're teaching us about suffering and about conventional reality, and see them as upaya or skillful means when we're feeling really sad because of something that happened. Observing for ourselves, you know, okay, how did this come to be? How, you know, and is there a way that we could end our suffering or other people's suffering, you know, in now or in the future? Another thing to observe is kind of related to rules. Someone sort of suggested the question of, asking ourselves, by what am I bound? What is it that holds me in place? Am I trying to get something or am I trying to avoid something? Do I have some sort of rules about how I should be in the world? I guess I want to be clear that I'm not trying to pull apart the rules of our society. There's nothing bad about conventional reality, and there's nothing bad about rules, and there's nothing bad about any of these things. They are often extremely helpful, and there's no, you know, there's really no getting out of conventional reality. But I think it's, and we wouldn't want to, or I wouldn't want us to. But I guess what I'm suggesting is that through practicing with some of these things, we can sometimes taste a little bit of the difference between conventional reality and ultimate reality. And I can't do much to say much about ultimate reality, except that I think sometimes we can sort of, you know, perceive that. I think that that's awakening. So I told you there were two koans that sort of illustrate this to me. The other one, I've seen this aspect of this koan in more than one koan, but you will hear sometimes in a koan a teacher saying, you know, asking a question to the assembly and then saying, you know, answer and I will hit you 30 times. And then saying, don't answer and I will hit you 30 times. And I like that. You know, there's no way to win, right? You know, there's no way to win in this situation. You can answer or not, and you're still going to get hit 30 times. So, you know, how can you be free in that situation? There's something that you would like to avoid is going to happen. How can you be free? You know, and what I've sometimes taken from that koan is just the sense of, what is it that you have to say? You know, what is it that I, what's my own authentic response? If I'm going to get hit for answering and I'm going to get hit for not answering, I might as well just, you know, be whatever I am in that moment. So the appropriate response, you know, depends on the situation or context. And if we think that we can give an appropriate response and avoid being punished somehow, that's maybe not always completely true. You know, sometimes it is just not possible to avoid getting your wrist slapped for something, rightly or wrongly, and yet, you know, we kind of have to be ourselves. And so I think, you know, what I maybe kind of want to conclude with is, I think, you know, the middle way is very much finding an appropriate response to our lives. How can we be, you know, ourselves and become ourselves as much as possible, knowing that there is not really just, you know, ourselves. We're all parts of each other and parts of everyone and everything that we've ever met. And yet, you know, so that's maybe more on the level of ultimate reality, but yet here we are, you know, and how can we be, and how can we take care of ourselves and take care of each other in such a way that we can help to ease some of the suffering that just, you know, kind of like the koan, maybe sometimes seems kind of unavoidable. Unavoidable. You know, we are, and so if we are trying to sort of always, you know, control conventional reality and trying to, you know, see, okay, I'm doing something in conventional reality and I shouldn't, that's maybe not the way either. We can't really, conventional reality is continuously arising and things are continuously happening and we can't control it and we can't control always our response. But how do we find a way to live, you know, without suffering, and in such a way that we don't create suffering for others? So with that, I will maybe just, you know, see if we can have a little bit of a discussion. We've got a few minutes. Or if anyone has any questions about anything, I think, you know, especially people who are joining us for the first time, if you have any questions about anything that happened today, that's okay too. Alex, I think I saw you first.
Thank you. I had kind of interesting thoughts. You were wrapping up your discussion here. I've been reading this book on the criminal justice system in the United States and kind of it really brought up some interesting parallels because this book kind of deconstructs the conventional view of the criminal justice system, the ultimate view of the criminal justice system anyways. And it made me wonder about what, you know, people that end up being victimized by the criminal justice system, what is an appropriate response? Because, you know, there is, like, here's the conventional nature of the system that's going to sweep you up into the system, and to a certain degree, on some level, you have to have an appropriate, you know, day-to-day response to that. But also, there's an awareness that the system is wrong, and there's some major, every step of the way, some major problems with the system. So it raises some interesting questions of what is an appropriate response if there is some really problems with, you know, conventional reality.
Are you asking or? It seems like, there are some major problems in society, and that's one of them. And yet, I guess I wonder if the appropriate response for each person has to do with how they're encountering that in their life. You know, if you are someone who's been wronged by that, you will have particular circumstances in which you've been wronged by that, and that might lead you to react in particular ways that might create more suffering for you or less. If you are someone who's observing it from the outside, then it's impacting you in a different way than if you're on the receiving end of injustice. But you cared enough to read this, and so it must be stirring up ideas or questions, at least, you know, maybe not answers, of, you know, what do I want to do about this? You know, that aren't always so easily answered, but they're your questions, you know, and they wouldn't necessarily be anybody else's questions, and you can maybe only give them a provisional answer, but you can do something, you know. And it seems like we often feel in situations like that, like, you know, I'm only one person, what can I do? And if everyone does something that they can do, that's a lot. You know, that's something. Whether that will solve the problem or, you know, partially solve a problem and create more problems inadvertently while doing that, I can't really predict. But yeah, it's hard. That's a great example of suffering, you know, a huge concrete aspect of suffering that everybody has to encounter a little bit differently. There isn't really one right way, maybe, to encounter that. John?
No, I've been very aware in my meditation. meditation over the years of how much time my mind goes to planning. And some of it's worthwhile, some of it actually helps, but a lot of it, one of the things I notice is that the world is planning. I don't actually do all those planned things. And another thing I've become more aware of lately is that the I, who is planning to do all these things that I, what my mind doesn't take into account, is that I, that person, changes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm noticing, you know, if I think back, what I did 5, 10, 15 years ago, that was a different I who did those things. Because when I look at that now, I was like, oh, I did that?
Yeah. Oh, that's a
surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And yet when I project into the future, it's as if the same person will be present.
It's so, it sounds like you're kind of also pointing out that it, whatever it was dependent on the context that you were in, and who you were at that time was dependent on the context that you were in. Yeah, so there wasn't a you. And yeah, I think that's true of anyone. You know, we might encounter someone that we knew, you know, 20 years ago, and we have a very different interaction with that person, you know, today. Because we're different and they're different. And thanks for the observation. I think you had raised the gentleman in the chair, you had raised your hand, and you didn't raise it again though. Did you want to ask a question or offer an observation?
Yes. How meditation can help you to cope with grief? A family member passed away.
Yeah.
Still there.
You want to get a sense of how meditation can help with profound grief when it's a family member who's passed away.
Yes.
It really is, and if that is you, I am very sorry for your loss. It's you know, meditation as we practice it in Zen, it doesn't mean that you have to stop your thinking, and it doesn't mean that you have to think any particular thing or feel any particular thing. One thing that I've experienced when grieving is that sometimes it is helpful to have a place to just sit very quietly without distraction and let whatever is happening in you just kind of happen for a while, whether that's sadness or, you know, anger or maybe a happy memory of an encounter that you had with that person, or, you know, or grief or whatever is going on. And our school of meditation, as we practice it, is really just that and nothing more. It's a space to just sit and be present and allow whatever is happening to happen. And yet also not to do that for, you know, too long. I mean, we have a set point at which we get up and we go do things. I think both of those things are actually very helpful in working with times when we're really grieving. It's helpful to have a time to just sit, and it's also helpful to have a time when we have to get up from sitting and distract ourselves and find ways to cope with the things that we still have to do. The grief, you know, meditation won't make the grief go away. As far as I am ever aware, I think, you know, the thing that helps with grief is time, and coming to a fuller appreciation of the people that we love and what we've lost and what we still have of them. And so, you know, meditation is maybe a part of that, but the thing that really helps is time. And so meditation is a time to do that. I think the other piece of meditation that I've experienced with grief is meditation is a time to do that just by ourselves. Or if that is just too painful, and there have been times when, you know, I just don't want to be left alone with myself, to sit with other people so that we have a feeling of, okay, other people are doing this, other people are, you know, offering some support. for where we are right then. Does anyone, other people, everyone I think probably here has had some grief, and I don't know if other people have used meditation as a way of helping with that, or have anything you want to say. I don't know your name.
Brent. Meditation taught me that I can't run away from my grief. That the only way to deal with my grief was to deal with my grief.
Yeah.
That was my practice a few years ago when I lost someone. And, I think I have siblings who were part of it too, and they weren't into meditation, so they went on like things were normal, and then I didn't. And, but through meditation, it's funny because through time they suffered so much more because they tried so hard to not acknowledge it.
Mm.
You know, like I have relatives. My grandfather who passed away. And he was very close, and you know, my grandmother was one of them. She would set the table for two. Like she was in such denial of his, his loss. You know, and I think you know other people in my family who are actually Buddhists and more than just one. Buddhist actually cried the hardest at the beginning and then lived the longest with it, you know, but learned to live on this different thing, actually.
Sounds like you're also pointing out that it can't be done all at once. It's
right.
it's a process, and
yeah,
we work our way through. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I think lots of painful emotions are like grief, and I'm sure many of us come to meditation because we hope it's going to make us feel better. Stop feeling grief or anger or fear or something like that. And I think it's, you know, grief is there and it's responding to something real. I think what's also true is that there are different ways we experience emotion. We can be awake with it and feel that legitimate emotion. And sometimes we get caught up in emotions. So we don't have emotions, it's kind of like they have us. And we sort of are taken over and wallow. And I think it can go, you know, most emotions come sort of as a wave. It'll be back. But if you sit with it and are awake with it, feel that emotion differently. So if you're awake with it and sitting with it, then if you're just sitting and wallowing in grief, I don't think there's anything. You know, that's just wallowing. I think that if you're with it and awake, it comes. You're incredibly sad. It sort of calms down a little bit. It'll be back. It's only going to be time that takes care of it. But there does seem to be a sort of healing aspect to being with the pain rather than just being caught up in the pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of like if you've ever snapped at someone inadvertently because you were feeling some pain in your life, and then later you kind of realize, oh, you know, she didn't really deserve that. I wasn't really mad at her, but I had this pain and I didn't really notice that it was there. That's maybe how meditation can, part of how meditation can help us be aware that, you know, yeah, I am really carrying around this heavy heart from this loss, and to find a way to bear it and be aware of it, and in being aware of it, not then, you know, let it affect how we treat the people that we care about around us. One of you, you want to?
Sure.
Okay.
Well, yeah, a couple quick thoughts. One is I really agree that, you know, there's a time to sort of sit with things when when a person's grieving, and other times where you've just kind of got to get fit. For me, sometimes I need to do something physically, kind of get away from it so that then I can sit with it. And I think in sitting with grief, when I've, you know, been with that, like the people I've lost, you know, it's easy to just kind of get caught up, like Douglas was saying, with this sort of overwhelming sense of grief. But if you can sit with it for a little while, it's funny what will come up, because the people we lose, it's not like there's one thing that's called grief. You know, each person that we're with, that we love, that we lose, we have complex relationships with. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, I think, the grieving process is, if we can really be with that, we see, oh yeah, it's so weird, this little thing over here is hitting me so hard right now that I never would have thought of. And why is that? And what does that have to do with my relationship? Because, well, sometimes we just think, okay, we're letting go of somebody. But there isn't this fixed thing we're letting go of. It's a million little details mm-hmm. that are dying. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And coming back. You know, we have to see the other side of it. But I think if we can bring some even curiosity and openness to that, I think meditation can allow us to really see those little, you know, millions of details and kind of make peace with them. And I think that's why it takes so long, is we have to make peace with so many little bits,
yeah.
not just yeah. one thing.
Yeah, that's
great. Thank you.
Okay. Deborah.
There's a line from the movie Kung Fu Panda that I really like, and it is, we meet our destiny on the road we take to avoid it. I'm very aware it's true for me. I can fall into the trap of suffering, whatever it is, grief or anger or whatever, and being afflicted with it. Somehow if I do it right, I can avoid it, or I can go around it. And so meditation helps me, I think, to just sit with it. Just be with whatever's there and try to understand my relationship to it and mm-hmm. how I might feed it or deny it. But to have some patience with that process of just noticing how I react inside to it. And it seems to want to ease it or shift it in some way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.